Welcome to Toenails, a podcast about running and also not about running. I'm Sydney Allen Ash, and before we get into this week's episode, story time. When New York's lockdown started, I started walking from my new apartment at the edge of Clinton Hill and Bed-Stuy to Fort Greene Park. It was an attempt to salvage a modicum of socially distanced social interaction. I would dawdle around the park a little bit, work out, look at dogs, and then walk back. And it was on one of these walks that I first saw him. Before we go any further, I need anyone who lives within walking distance of Fort Greene Park to take an oath of secrecy to not bait me the fuck out. Full disclosure, I totally definitely do not know this man. And I may or may not be thoroughly embellishing this memory of him. He's in his mid-30s, white, with buzzed reddish-brown hair and freckles. He's a morning runner with a soccer player's build, a thick torso, nice arms, great running form. There are simply just lots of hot people in New York City, but this guy was stunning in the way that normal hot people can be, whatever that means. There he was, running down a tree-lined street. Like DeKalb or St. James Place, it doesn't really matter. Picture brownstones and morning sun. It was early enough in the day that he could be a solo performance, you know, before the grand ensemble of New York City takes the stage. And truly, what a solo it was. He was sweating through his barely there gray-beige heathered tee. This delicate layer of fabric clinging to his skin, yet fluttering away ever so gently with every stride. It was delicious. And also stylish and cool and modest and interesting.
I painted a picture of an ideal man, built on a split-second memory. He was a rigorous, stylish, tech-abstaining, but not an annoying way, devoted, eco-conscious, social justice warrior. He's the ideal man. We're basically married. Please do not ruin this for me.
For me, this is where sports and running in particular come to life. In the theater of the public sphere. But I have to question my own thinking in this dreamscape. Is my husband actually as virtuous a hero as he seems? At some point in our evolution, we decided that good athletes were good people. Sports became a secular religion, athletes became demigods, gyms into churches, fitness routines into rituals. Everything was performed both for their inherent good, but also as a reminder of our devotion to winning, to progress, to victory. And this hottie on the street is that demigod. He's a symbol of the aspirational athleticism that all of society, you know, my googly eyes and everyone else's, that we admire and we deem good and virtuous. But the inverse is equally assumed to be true. Individuals, societies, whole nations of people without a clear control over their bodies, a clear mandate for their physique, are looked down upon. They don't embody our vision of progress, of winning. They're bad. They're unproductive. They're stagnant. This narrow vision of success and winning within sports has shapeshifted across centuries and generations, but it's never lost its grip. But have we ever paused to seriously ask the question, does winning mean we are good? Or does it just mean we have won? Taking a page from Jenny Odell's book, How to Do Nothing, which I will probably come back to a couple times throughout this episode, I need to make something clear. I am turning my back on this romanticized history of sport. I want to dig up a more complete telling of what it means and what it can mean for other people. The current narrative is not only incomplete, but the commonly accepted history of sport and of running is truly just factually inaccurate. The sanitized, brand-safe origin story of running tells us that several white men, like Arthur Lydiard, Bill Bowerman, Phil Knight, Steve Prefontaine, Frank Shorter, and Jim Fix, discovered and popularized running. End of story. I mean, popularized maybe, but discovered? Do we really need to reference this cult of personality to understand where running comes from?
why do we do that? Running did not just happen because of Arthur, Bill, Phil, Steve, Frank, and Jim. It's part of a much larger movement that is at once an ideology, a ritual, and a brand built around political, cultural, and economic incentives. To tell a story that neglects this broad, holistic narrative is not only boring, but an injustice to those that it does not include. That said, I'm not here to criticize running itself. The way you've chosen to run or take part in the culture is yours and yours alone, but I'm here to provide an alternative perspective. As Rebecca Solnit said in Hope in the Dark, the best way to resist a monolithic institution is not with a monolithic movement, but with multiplicity itself. Throughout this episode, we'll move through four key phases in the evolution of sport and society. Between those, we'll hear from people who, through their refusal, are creating an alternative space. Not exactly an escape from our reality, but another way of engaging with the culture of running as it actually exists. I'm compelled by these stories and the people behind them because it's clear evidence that the future is already out there. We're just not looking hard enough. Act 1. While the deification of victory, you know, turning those who win into gods, is as old as human history itself, for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to fast forward a bit to the 1800s, where the makings of our contemporary sport as religion begin to coalesce. At this time, British society was lamenting a perceived loss in manliness. Manual labor was falling victim to industrialization. The women's emancipation movement and new waves of immigration were diversifying the workforce. Many of the country's familiar venues for this one-dimensional vision of masculinity began to disappear, or at the very least, began to look different. This, combined with the guilt of colonization, led to an increased interest on the part of the white male elite to institutionalize their power, to make sure that, at its core, their dominance remained intact, that shit would never truly change. Knee-deep in their efforts to colonize the planet, the British seat of power was particularly well-versed in multi-pronged, aggressive, oppressive approaches to shaping society in the name of control. And amongst those familiar modes of subjugation, religion, censorship, cultural genocide, a grand idea was born. Muscular Christianity. One that would remain fundamental to our current vision of sport and success. Muscular Christianity is an ideology that, on its surface, is characterized by a patriotic and patriarchal belief that for men to be good Christians, good members of society, they must also be physically fit, disciplined, self-sacrificial, and dominant. Muscular Christianity espoused the belief that it was important for men to be physically dominant, not simply for the practical benefits of a strong physique, or the health ones for that matter, but because it was morally righteous. Below the surface, muscular Christianity reeks of colonial rhetoric, relying on a Platonic vision of society where top-down subjugation and control are necessary aspects of social progress. And just like indigenous cultures, practices, people, in this view of society and social progress, the body needed to be controlled, refigured, optimized. A muscular Christian body is like a field of grass turned into a great suburban lawn. And on the note of muscular Christianity's connections to suburbia, just know that we'll dive into that later on. This idea made its way across Europe and around the world in various forms and was embodied and disseminated by institutions like the YMCA, the YWCA, Boy Scouts, and later the Olympic movement. Basically, wherever modern society was taking shape, muscular Christianity was imposing its will, veiling a colonial and patriarchal imperative under the guise of moral goodness. Physical dominance and control was not only sold as good and right, but holy, ordained by God. One note about the global nature of muscular Christianity. Though I won't really be covering them in this episode, you should know that there is evidence for movements related to muscular Christianity all around the whole entire world. So much so that I've read about muscular Buddhism, muscular Hinduism, and more factions that I'm sure exist that I don't even know about. These are so wild, but they are stories for another day. Back to Britain in the 1850s. Enter rugby school, where headmaster Thomas Arnold reformed and revitalized the school's curriculum through the lens of muscular Christianity. This curriculum sought to invigorate the student body's masculinity, one that, in the eyes of the British public, seemed to be waning with this feminization of society. Arnold's success with rugby school was celebrated across the country and beyond, and their reputation was immortalized in the famous fictional novel Tom Brown's School Days, written by author and rugby school alumni Thomas Hughes.
Tom Brown's School Days. And what days they were. Remember him? That young'un with the spirit of a lion?
As an aside, literary historians note that the representation of Tom Brown's School Days is heavily influenced by Hughes' own beliefs of what a good school, a good man, and a good society should be. It seems that Thomas Hughes' own beliefs leaned even more heavily on sports than maybe Thomas Arnold did in the reality of rugby school. We should take heed of this bias as foreshadowing for the ways muscular Christianity and the dominance of sport has Frankensteined across the world for the following century. School Days, as it turns out, was a distinctly viral take on muscular Christianity. It sold 30,000 copies in the years following its 1857 publication, and it was even translated into Japanese for the purpose of advancing their own conservative ideology. Back closer to home, School Days and rugby school caught the eye of European aristocrats like Frenchman Pierre de Coubertin, who sought to use the curriculum for his own purposes. At the time, France had just lost the Franco-Prussian War to Germany. Coubertin viewed this loss as an indication of the degradation of French power on the international stage. So, at the ripe, mature, decision-making age of 20, Coubertin traveled to rugby school to see what was really good. On this trip, he became totally enamored by the English institution and its teachings. While historians believe Coubertin maybe was more influenced by the fictionalized overemphasis of sport in School Days than by the real school itself, it doesn't really matter because he was hooked. Coubertin believed heavily in the message that athletic endeavors were the key to making stronger, more prosperous nations and better men to lead them.
You'll need activities to build up endurance. Endurance that will help to make your early days of service less painful and more profitable.
And so it became his life's work to bring this vision of sport to the world stage.
And be sure to include competitive sports. Sports that will give you the feeling of cooperation and striving to win.
Although Coubertin's promotion of muscular Christianity did not lead to the educational reform in France like he had hoped, he was able to successfully campaign for the reinvention of the modern Olympics, a movement that would eventually bring many of the world's countries together to compete for athletic supremacy and national glory, and all under the guise of more marketable goals like world peace and international diplomacy. If there is a moral to this episode, maybe it's just that history repeats itself. And frankly, it can, because muscular Christianity's influence is covert. Its appearance is malleable, always evolving. Whether it's selling higher productivity, national spirit, better education, or world peace, the goodness and purity of sport are being advanced as an extension of a much older and more powerful movement. Patriotism and patriarchy as good as the state, the nation, and the victorious. Act one, done. Let's review before we move on. Control over bodies on an individual and a societal level has been branded as a requirement for social progress since at least the 1800s. A product of colonization, this belief has informed every aspect of society and transformed into many more insidious and covert projects, sport being just one of them. But what I'm asking here is that we acknowledge this fact.
We pull the wool back from our collective eyeballs and begin dreaming up things that move beyond it. If sport doesn't need to be about control and competition, what could it be? Act 2. In contrast to professional sports leagues, the Olympic Games were founded as a forum for the romanticized vision of the amateur athlete. This particular notion of amateurism came from muscular Christianity. In the vision of the modern Olympic Games, sport is not a profession sullied by money and greed, but a way of training the soul, of displaying the goodness of man. And at the time, it was largely men. The amateur code, which was a formal rule for decades in the Olympics, barred athletes from making money from their wins. This code was also low-key responsible for preventing the mixing of classes, maintaining the divide between those who could joyously compete for the love of the game and those professional athletes from lower classes who couldn't afford to compete for free. The collateral effect here is clear. Competition and the virtuosity that came with it was limited to the wealthy. IOC committee presidents, well into the 20th century, fiercely maintained that, much to the athletes' collective frustration, there should not be money awarded to athletes in the games. This type of old-school virtue signaling was tactical, furthering the Olympic status as a pure expression of athletic ability, Christian and virtuous. In retrospect, we should really see that this pureness is not righteous, but intentional and exclusionary. This fantasy of sports as a morally pure activity was explicitly cemented into the Olympic project with the amateur code. All the while, the famously corrupt IOC was willingly turning a blind eye to under-the-table bribery on the part of brands, government officials, and whole nations who sought to maintain the narrative that Olympic athletes were aspirational Renaissance men who competed effortlessly and joyously for the love of the game. The untouchable tenets of self-sacrifice, patriotic duty, discipline, manliness, and the moral and physical beauty of athleticism are baked into the creation of the modern Olympics. One cannot exist without the other. And if those untouchable tenets are simultaneously what is justified as making the games great and pure, an objectively fair playing ground, I've got to ask, for whomst are they fair? Is it any wonder that the IOC committee well into the 20th century was comprised solely of European aristocrats and the odd millionaire from America, and that all of its presidents have been white? Is it surprising that there were exactly zero women involved in planning, participating in, or even watching the Olympics for the first few decades of its existence? Or that there has never been an out trans Olympian despite being allowed to compete since 2004? To this day, the IOC, brimming with systemic bias, moves unchecked as the sole governing body, determining who hosts the games, what games are played and how, and who participates on an individual and a national level. Despite this, popular belief will tell you that the Olympics are an objective arena for peak athletic competition, an example of diplomatic success and international cooperation. But really, the Olympics are less an arena for promoting equality amongst nations than they are a reminder of stratification's reach. Sports, on the main stage, are designed for a very small subset of society to demonstrate their privilege, to ratify it, to remind us of who wins, who can win, and by proxy, who doesn't even get to play. While there have been countless stunning displays of athleticism, beauty, and humanity at the Olympic Games, its obvious exclusions and blind spots should complicate its role in defining our sporting traditions. In Act 1, I spent time recounting this very brief and cursory history of the evolution of muscular Christianity. I did this to unveil a larger ideological trend within this familiar and known example of the Olympics. I'm using it as a common starting ground, one that we all know and can understand. But really, this isn't just about the Olympics.
The games are but a very obvious indication of the way in which all other sporting institutions are touched by the legacy of muscular Christianity. So with that, let's return to the original question. What does winning mean? The Olympics says that winning at their games makes you the best in the world. When really, winning at the Olympics means you are just the best in their world. And to say otherwise is an injustice to all the people we know that doesn't include. Fast forward to present day, and we can see the Olympic ruling to exclude Caster Semenya as the modern legacy of these same beliefs. To get another opinion on how this control, exclusion, and inclusion play out in running off the Olympic stage, I called up Emma Cameron, an ultra runner in the Midwest.
It was always that same thing of like the road marathon, and it had like, you know, hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people, like all, I don't know, packed together doing this really highly regimented thing that, you know, everyone was so gung-ho about, like, okay, like toeing the line, like I gotta get my 2 seconds shaved off, you know, this time. And it was a world of difference in trail running. Like my first 50K, I think had like 30 people, and it had this like friendly, joyful atmosphere. That was an eye opener for me. And like everyone is just so happy to be out on the trails and having like a bunch of fun. And every trail runner I've met, I'm usually like pretty open about, like, I don't like say, oh, hey everyone, I'm trans or whatever, but like it'll come up at some point. And, you know, friends that I meet, everyone is super like comfortable with that. And like, you know, I have a lot of cis friends, cis women who are runners, and they're like, oh yeah, like they might like joke and like, oh, don't go on this FKT, you're gonna steal my record or whatever. Like, but they, you know, they mean well. They're not like, it's unfair for you to participate, and we like, you know, we begrudgingly are not saying anything or whatever. As much as running shouldn't be about all this categorization and it should be more about the joy and things, I've always had the sense, like, I want to be fair. You know, I want to like be competing in the female category on a basis where other people are saying like, that makes sense. And the rules that, you know, the IOC and like all these other running groups have gone by recently is that, okay, keep your testosterone levels below this certain threshold, and then there's basically no difference between, you know, cis and trans female athletes at that point, because testosterone is supposedly, you know, the main determinant of performance in running, at least. So like, to clarify, I guess, like, I had to like monitor it for a while, and I don't anymore. I was following that pretty religiously to, you know, this point of like, okay, so like now I feel comfortable in entering these races. But it's definitely like just kind of this ever-present anxiety. And it still sort of is, you know, like I always have this sense that like I'm going to be at a race and, you know, someone's going to say something, and you know, even like, you know, it wouldn't matter, but still, just the fact that, you know, there is that like possibility that my body could be controlled in that way is just, it's scary to me. You know, I want to have this pure experience with running and my body and all these things. And like, sometimes like there is a possibility I would not be able to do that. And that's like upsetting. I do wonder, like, I can go back to this idea of having more anxiety about these like shorter distance races. And as you get up in the distances, in terms of ultra running, like the gender difference in like performance kind of like vanishes, you know, in this race that, the 240-mile race, Moab 240, Courtney Dahlwalter won it outright on the inaugural race. She beat like all the men by like 12 hours. You know, when you get into these like 200-milers and even like 100-milers and just a lot of these ultra-distance races, I think there's this sense that I had that it's like that doesn't really like matter as much that I'm trans, and like there's not going to be an issue of like, oh, like 2 seconds difference. Not that I even like really care about that either way too. Like, I'm there for the experience. I'm not like trying to win or like place or whatever it is. So I think I was gravitated towards the, you know, the running and the races and all these, the community that embodies those philosophies.
Act 3. Is there anyone over 60 listening? If there is, and I doubt there is, you may want to skip this part because it's all your fault. Or stick around and learn something. Up to you. Before I get into it, I want to quickly recognize another one of my main resources for this podcast up until this point. It's called Winning is the Only Thing: Sports in America Since 1945. It's written by James S. Olson and Randy Roberts. It's available for free on the Internet Archive. So where we left off, the Olympics had been set up, thanks to wealthy and slightly misguided intentions, but it was actually kind of lame until the 1930s. It only really popped off in 1936 at the Berlin Olympics with Hitler's terrifying presentation of New Germany.
And meanwhile, a packed stadium and flag-draped cheering streets greet Chancellor Hitler on his way to perform the opening ceremony.
But then, World War II, obviously, canceled two rounds of the Olympics in 1940 and 1944. So we're just going to fast forward past that whole period of time and start in 1945, after the war.
The first important thing you can do is to be sure you know what communism really is.
The time that followed the U.S. atomic attacks in Japan in 1945 was characterized by an uneasy sense of intense nationalism and competition.
In other words, know your enemy.
Even more than before, shows of dominance in sports became increasingly symbolic of political and economic power. This played out on a local level too, with important sporting bodies like the NCAA exacerbating this trend by allowing colleges to give scholarships to college athletes. This is a true tipping point in the explosion of collegiate sport culture, which we don't even really have time to get into in this episode, but we'll probably talk about in the future. Coincidentally, this ruling from the NCAA is, in 1948, the same year that Bill Bowerman became head track coach at the University of Oregon. Divine timing. On a global level, in the 1950s, sports shifted from being something of a European export to being a product firmly made and manufactured in America.
Inside Sports, with your host from the University of Oklahoma, Bud Wilkinson.
This was also reflected in the IOC by the election of Avery Brundage as the first American IOC president in 1952. At the height of the Cold War, Brundage's election only served to intensify tensions between the Soviet Union and the United States. This ideological clash between East and West was being played out on an Olympic level. Proliferated by advances in mass media, with print, radio, and TV at their disposal, Olympic events were painted as a titanic struggle between the free world and communism, between state socialism and bourgeoisie capitalism. And captivated by the media narrative, the public interest in the games skyrocketed, further entrenching the Olympic Games' influence in controlling our public narrative surrounding sport. This was the world that baby boomers in America were born into, a messy combination of mass media and global political tensions. Just as this generation was coming of age, the young and handsome John F. Kennedy was elected into office. You could see him as a presidential choice emblematic of the youth boom that was taking place. That year, in America, 1961, half of the country's population was under 30. By 1964, the median age had dropped to 27, and in 1966 to 25. For context, the median age right now in North America is like 38. It was the 1960s. You know, those 60s, hippies against the war in Vietnam, love-ins, teach-ins, Woodstock, psychedelics, rebellion, and loud, self-righteous rejections of materialism. And it was everywhere, college campuses, city streets, and beyond. But in 1967, things got real. This first wave of baby boomers graduated from university, and their transformation from hippies to yuppies, or young urban professionals, was underway. The practical challenges of maintaining this fiery, anti-corporate, anti-establishment rebellion became frankly too heavy for white 25-year-olds, and as gravity also took hold of their youthful bodies,
This free, loving future they had imagined was starting to wrinkle and fade.
Ladies and gentlemen, now there are several things that one could talk about.
1968 was a turbulent and pivotal year for race relations in America.
There are so many problems facing our nation and our world that one could just take off anywhere.
Martin Luther King was assassinated, and student protesters at the Chicago Democratic National Convention faced the government's backlash as they unleashed the police and the National Guard. While Black people had been experiencing this sort of violent assault on their freedom since they arrived in America, this highly visible, widely disseminated experience of violence was, in my opinion, a turning point for the white protesters who were a part of the fight. That's not to mention those who witnessed these protests from the comfort of their living rooms, stark and in color.
There are literally two Americas.
From this point on, active enthusiasm for the civil rights movement became more segregated, more contentious. And many young white hippies transitioned to yuppies, retreating from politics into a reality of their own making. This symbolized a shift in tactics. The possibility of fighting back and winning against the police, as well as successfully opposing national institutions, seemed bleak. So instead of changing the world, they lowered their ambitions. In this moment of intensity and violence, yuppies sought the feeling, the momentary illusion of righteousness.
The opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all of their dimensions.
This retreat from distinctly more difficult collective aims led to white flight en masse to the suburbs.
This is Levittown, Pennsylvania, a new suburban community of 60,000 people.
A sense of community was built in these suburbs that permitted those who could fulfill the slightly less ambitious goal of individual happiness.
With its giant shopping center, it is fairly typical of communities all over America.
This was a smooth, frictionless world, devoid of the impurities of civil rights activism, devoid of the death of Black people, and devoid of the very hard work needed to move the country forward. And this was the sanitized, neatly trimmed American lawn where the seed of jogging culture was ready to be sown. Now, before we go any further, I want to bring us back to our goal here. In this episode, we're trying to figure out how the virtue of athleticism came about, why we deify athletes, and what winning really means. I am, as my fave Jenny O'Dell puts it, attending to the past in the future's name. And honestly, this often just means questioning the one-dimensional narratives we've been taught and complicating them in the name of justice. Here's a quick review of where we're at. Muscular Christianity was born as a colonizing ideology built on the idea that the natural state of things, in this case, our bodies, needed to be controlled, disciplined, and trained to be seen as good. Next, the modern Olympics were created in the wake of muscular Christianity, the goodness of athleticism as a tool to bring us together. Alas, the game's systemic biases reveal it to be a thinly veiled, racialized, gendered, and economically incentivized tool for exclusion and national peacocking on the world stage.
Aww.
And lastly, the fitness boom was a psychic escape hatch for white flight, an avenue for, in quotations, burnt out white people to retreat from engaging in civil rights activism and dive further into their own navels. Does this sound a little bit like your IG feed? And now we arrive at our fourth and final act. So white baby boomers who had rioted as students finished university and discovered that they didn't really have what it takes to become freedom fighters. Who saw that coming? Instead, they retreated into a reality of their own making with slightly less ambitious goals, scaling down the dream of collective freedom for a utopic world of their own making. Let's return to 1968 to take a second look at the big picture. Martin Luther King, assassinated. Robert F. Kennedy, also assassinated. Countless student protests held across the world in the name of anti-war, anti-corporate, and anti-Olympics, as well as in support of labor rights, civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, and more. After a Black-led boycott campaign of the 1968 Mexico City Olympics, sprinters Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists while standing on the podium. 1968 was also the year after Muhammad Ali refused to fight in the Vietnam War, and the year before Catherine Switzer became the first official woman to run the Boston Marathon. At this time, Black intellectuals like James Baldwin and musicians like Nina Simone were at the peak of their careers. It's also the year before the Stonewall riots. All the while, the white escape from political spheres is taking shape into full worlds with neighborhoods, brands, books, and businesses. In 1968, the Nike Cortez, basically their most famous shoe, was released. 1968 was 2 years after Bill Bowerman, co-founder of Nike, and W.E. Harris published Jogging, the book credited with popularizing jogging in the U.S. In 1968, aerobics was becoming a thing, hot off the heels of Kenneth H. Cooper's wildly popular book of the same name. It was the year before Jazzercise was founded, the year before Woodstock, and the year after the Summer of Love. Are you sensing a divide here?
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
This year, and the decade or so following it, were characterized by an increasingly atomized and segregated America. Two separate visions of progress were taking shape. One that sought to engage with reality, read, one that had to engage with reality, and another that sought to retreat into itself. As affluent white people retreated, so they were sold a number of panaceas to soothe their guilt and pander to this new sense of individualism. The 70s and 80s saw the creation of fitness studios, juice bars, trendy athletic gear, and also psychotherapy, Scientology, all-purpose gyms, country clubs, racquetball courts, tennis courts, swimming pools, cycling places, weightlifting gyms, and aerobic dance studios. White people were improving themselves, right? Now, to clarify, some form of retreat is, of course, necessary to contemplate and consider the way forward during chaotic periods of social unrest. The present moment is no exception, but the emphasis here is not on taking a well-deserved break, but on ghosting altogether. You know that old saying, with great power comes great responsibility? Well, forfeiting that responsibility is an act of privilege, an act of willful ignorance, an act of cowardice, and most of all, it's just delusional. Just by ignoring a reality doesn't make it go away. You know the old saying, if you don't do something about the problem, you are part of the problem? Jenny O'Dell characterizes this in How to Do Nothing as the impossibility of retreat. And I quote, "Removal and contemplation were necessary to be able to see what was happening, but that same contemplation would always bring one back around their responsibility to and in the world." For boomers, their retreat into themselves did not bring them back around with a revitalized sense of purpose. They didn't like go on their juice cleanse and then come back and be like, yo, let's fight anti-Black racism. They left and largely stayed gone. They sat in their privilege, exercised it as a right to abstain. Participation in the political sphere was a thing they simply chose not to do. They bought the feeling of freedom, while others were forced to feel the fight. The marketing rhetoric at the time presents as sort of a bridge between the legacy of muscular Christianity in the 1800s and the rise of self-care and wellness culture today. By jazzercising, jogging, and juicing, the affluent white boomer could embody a mastery of self through careful practice and discipline. This narrative was reinforced by mass media and perpetuated by platitudes about our inherent duty to take care of, ourselves. Is it any wonder that the boomers became the first me generation? A smooth, frictionless utopia was constructed by corporate America's discovery of lifestyle marketing and white America's political insecurities. The fabricated non-places where these activities took place, gyms, fitness studios, perfectly manicured suburban lawns, were that utopia. They were no place at all. They were sanitized of the struggle for life and dignity taking place in the reality just outside of their neighborhoods. While society has progressed since the 60s, we are, in many ways, fighting the same battles. For a reflection, reclamation, and proclamation on the power of running, here's Rio Lakeshore.
I am Rio Lakeshore out of California. I am a runner, writer, father, artist on so many levels, and lover of the sun. My approach to running is from a very spiritual stance. I feel that I run with soul, and it always feels like my running style evokes embodiment of rhythmic performance and some sort of flow. It's an expression. But see, I feel like it's on a bigger spectrum as to why we don't really think of it like that. I think we're trained, you know, from institution, like from school, from primary school on, you know. You think of physical education as just that. It's just like, okay, run the mile and try to get the best time, rather than encouraging kids to think outside the box with any sport that they do. Maybe encouraging more of a philosophy of movement, you know? So we don't do that. And that's why broader society just is so black and white about, you know, what running is, or it's not a perspective that they can understand. You think of sport as so fundamental and so like structured and scientific, rather than from the soul. Before I even got down to the structure of, you know, time splits and Strava and all that, and wearing a watch even, I was a free runner. So I just went with what I felt. At the time, I was living in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle. And I would run down to the lake. Golden Gardens is the name of this lake, this particular spot. And I would just run there and just be, you know, there wasn't a schedule or anything like that. And I think it just became that performance element for me. And I had viewers there who would sit in their car and watch the lake. But then along with the lake came this long, lanky dude with dreads just running. And in my head, it's always more artistic, more flowy, more like some sort of ballet piece. I don't know. So in my head, I'm thinking, oh, they're enjoying me as well as this other element of the ecosystem, if you will, you know? So, but yeah, when I'm running and I'm a big black guy, you know, I live in the industry area of LA, where there's a lot of white industry folks, liberals, quote unquote liberals, but they still have their biases. You know, they would still go on next door and say, there's this mysterious black guy running around the neighborhood and he's running for miles and he's doing, you know, I feed off of that shit. So I don't know. Can I swear? Is it okay to swear? Okay. Yeah. I feed off of that shit. That makes me want to do it more. That empowers me. It's, you know, I can think of surfers going into shark-filled water, knowing the risk, you know, but they continue to do it for that feeling, that empowerment of moving on water, knowing the risk, you know, knowing I could die, but I'm still in this moment. I have all this power on top of this water. That's the same feeling that I evoke when I'm running. Like, and not to compare white folks to sharks or anything. Maybe perhaps racist white folks, you know. But it's a fuck you moment. Like, I'm here and you can't stop me. I'm not gonna let you know, the murder of my people or the lynching of my people stop me from doing what I love and what you think I'm not supposed to be doing. I'm representing. Like, I always feel like I'm honoring my ancestors big time when I'm running as a free man. It's truly empowering for me to do that. And all fear is thrown out the window. There's no fear. It's just like going in strong, you know? You know, we're all just trying to find some sort of movement to help us cope with. And this is what I've found through the movement of running.
In order to understand this current moment, we need to understand where we came from. I saw a lot of articles popping up in the past couple months about the death of Ahmaud Arbery in relation to the whiteness of running, and a lot of people being like, how did we get here? Why is it like this? Running is so accessible. It's meant to be free for everyone. And hopefully through this episode, you're seeing how this narrative of like purity and freedom and sport being an equalizer in society is just impossible. Hopefully you're seeing the ways in which jogging and running and sports as cultural institutions in society have been created on grounds that are unequal. Hopefully you're seeing the ways that the virtues of running, the virtues of athleticism, are only accessible to a select few. The things that we create are embedded with our beliefs. It's impossible to separate the two. Sport was created as a utopia that was above the reality, that excluded those who couldn't participate on its terms. So as we seek to create a more equitable world, the question of how we participate in sports is a part of that. And I'm proposing that the current definition we have of our goal within sports, this vision of winning and progress, is something that deserves a second look. Are we better off now than we were in the 1800s? How much better? Are we winning yet? Honestly, at risk of sounding cliche, I think that we are. And the stories from Rio and from Emma affirm that for me. I think that maybe we just need to be reminded of how we are winning. Renegotiate what winning is and what it can be. And if we're lucky enough to be able to posit our own definition of winning, I think we should take that responsibility seriously. See you next time for episode 2 of Toenails, a podcast about running and also not about running. This episode was written and produced by me, Sydney Allen Ash, with editing from Nicholas Yim. Our design and all of those amazing videos that you've seen are made by Marvin Lau. And this episode featured custom music by Young Clancy.